Thank you very much, Richard and Pat. It is a great personal pleasure to be back in Cambridge, where I speak, and I perhaps should hesitate to say this in church, but where I speak to you as the heaven-sent representative of Governor Perry. I realized that this must be so. Earlier this week, when I was at my family place, my place in southern Vermont, and the governor was in Houston praying for rain, and God delivered, unfortunately, to the wrong address. It is true that now and for many years I live in Texas, in Austin, but it's not as far away in some ways as you may think. Some years ago, Senator Kennedy came to town for a political event, and I went over to say hello, and of course he recognized me and looked at me in some surprise and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Senator, what you have to realize is that Austin is just a warm suburb of Cambridge." It is finally a particular pleasure to be back in this church, where I attended Sunday school in the days under Reverend Ralph Helverson, when that consisted largely of learning the art of anti-war protest. So it's not the first time that I've been here in this place to oppose the policies of a president of the Democratic Party. And before I go down that road, let me note that it's a perilous one. Time and history have a way of changing judgments, as I found over 25 years at the LBJ School at the University of Texas at Austin, in close proximity to the family, veterans, and archives of that administration. Time and history may likewise change the present verdict on President Obama, but having said that, one has to go with the evidence in hand. My claim tonight is that we are in a single integrated great crisis that goes back 30 years that we have failed to diagnose, in part because it is politically inconvenient to do so, and in part because academic economics created for us a fool's paradise within which, as a matter of principle, that which has happened could not happen. The president's fault lies in delegating economic policy to a team comprised of people complicit in this fiasco, either from the political and pecuniary or the intellectual point of view, and in some instances, both. The fool's paradise emerged in the post-depression growth economics of the 1950s, a world of cheap resources, stable institutions, subdued banking, and within what was then called the free world, unchallenged American power, and also complete innocence of ecological constraints. In that world, getting the savings and investment rates right was apparently the major challenge. Everyone was honest, or they got caught, I suppose, if they weren't. Technology fell from the sky like a gentle rain and never did anyone any harm. Such a world never really existed, of course, and everyone knows it, but economics, for the most part, refuses to deal with the important problems. In the 1970s and 1980s, things got much worse. Economists abandoned the goal of high employment, of full employment, and retreated into a thicket of natural rates of unemployment, rational expectations, representative agent models, efficient markets reasoning, and dynamic stochastic general equilibrium systems. which no less than the present chair of the department, economics department at MIT, calls the current core of the discipline. While continuing largely to ignore resources, ecology, automation, conflict, financial instability, and fraud. If the phrases I mentioned a second ago don't mean anything to you, that's not accidental. The entire edifice has served to wall off modern economics from everything else, permitting clear lines to be drawn between people who matter and people who don't. Consensus among the insiders thus became the sovereign goal. Things are as they are because the economists say so. This consensus was never absolute, but the debate became a very narrow one. Basically between two groups, a perpetual motion machine society headquartered in Chicago, and a flaws and frictions faction headquartered largely here in Cambridge, but with branches up and down the East and the West coasts. Professor Paul Krugman, whom I admire greatly, calls these the freshwater and the saltwater schools, which in his famous New York Times Magazine essay, How the Economist Got It So Wrong, he accuses of mistaking beauty for truth. Beauty, he says, is the idea that capitalism is a perfect or nearly perfect system, gussied up with impressive-looking equations. It's a curious notion of beauty. I've never heard the phrase gussied up applied to the Venus de Milo. But never mind that. The important point is that any economist who did not agree with one of these two very narrowly separated positions was consigned to the backwater, to a diaspora of liberal arts colleges, shoestring think tanks, and Class B state universities, where it was possible to lead a perfectly respectable and even pleasant existence, but where, for practical and effective purposes, you ceased to exist. Three groups in particular wandered in this wilderness for many years. They were followers of the Anglo-Irish Cambridge University economist Wynn Godley, who placed great formal emphasis on getting basic accounting relationships right so that one might understand, for example, that public deficits supply financial resources to the private sector, dollar for dollar, penny for penny. When the government spends more than it takes in as taxes, the private sector necessarily has more income than it pays in taxes. Not to mention the relationship between the trade deficit and the budget deficit. When we supply reserves, financial reserves, to the world economy, we must necessarily import more than we export and run a corresponding deficit in the public accounts. The second group were the followers of an economist who spent most of his career at Washington University at St. Louis, Hyman Minsky, who stressed the inherent instability of financial markets, in particular that stability itself is a cause of instability, by the very simple mechanism that as time goes on in good times, people become overconfident and start demanding higher returns and pushing the bounds of what is possible. And the third group I would call with a certain amount of family pride the Galbraithians, who stressed the importance of organizations The great corporations and the institutions which in a well-run society balance their power, and who understood that it was a very bad idea to detach the chief executive from the firm by paying him according to stock market valuations, and who also understood that conventions and habits and the rule of law had to govern the conduct of organizations, or else they had the potential to collapse. Did the backwater economists, I coined that phrase, by the way, and claim trademark to it, understand what was coming down? I convened a group of them in June of 2008 and prepared a memorandum for the Obama campaign, which was dispatched on July 8th of that year. It reads in part, "The most important common ground was over the depth and severity of the ongoing financial crisis. Participants placed it out of the league of financial events since the early 1930s. One called it epochal and history-making. What distinguishes this crisis from the others is that it emerges from the United States, that is, from the center and not the periphery of the financial system. It reflects the collapse of a bubble in an economy driven by repetitive bubbles, and the bubble has been vectored into the financial structure in a uniquely complex and intractable way via securitization. This is a global crisis originating in the United States." The memo went on to predict a long slump through 2011 at least that would be met by inadequate stimulus packages, and to warn that the political capital of the new presidency risks being exhausted quite quickly in a series of short-term stimulus efforts that will do little more than buoy the economy for a few months each. Since they will not lead to a revival of private credit, every one of those efforts will ultimately be seen as too little too late, and therefore as ending in failure. Although at the time I was in contact at least several times a week with the Obama campaign team, this was in July, this was after Bear Stearns, but before Lehman Brothers and all the rest, the memorandum received no reply. The fact that the system, in particular, was riddled with fraud is something that the economics profession has found practically impossible to come to grips with, and that the political system has been at great pains to overlook or deny. The evidence has been presented, however, very clearly in excellent official reports, astonishingly good documents, the report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the report of the Special Investigator General of the TARP program, the Congressional Oversight Panel, the Senate Investigations Subcommittee. The import of this is beginning to dawn on the world as the Federal Housing Finance Agency files its massive lawsuits, nearly $200 billion so far, and as certain top bankers engage top criminal attorneys. But it should not have taken so long. The fraud was there for everyone to see. It was, in part, a simple matter of language. This was an industry where the product was called, by the people who produced it, liar's loans. Ninja loans, loans for people with no income, no job, or assets. Neutron loans, taken from the nuclear lexicon. Loans that would explode, destroying the people but leaving the buildings intact. The residue of the securitization was called toxic waste. What does this tell you? does it suggest perhaps that the people in the industry were aware that the work they were engaged in was not 100% honest? Would you eat in a restaurant where the waitstaff referred to the food as scum, sewage, and sludge? Pursuing this question of language, I think, we can help to understand what the system consisted of. Millions upon millions of documents were issued that were called mortgages. But they were not mortgages in any ordinary sense. They were not issued to people who were expected to pay them off. They were issued to people who were not expected to pay them off, who would have to refinance or who would default, and the lenders knew it. These were counterfeits. This was, in effect, a counterfeiting ring on a massive scale. The counterfeited documents had to be presented to an investing public. This is called laundering. It is what the credit agencies did when they took the mortgage-backed securities, which were junk and worse than junk, fraudulent to the core, and packaged them and labeled them as AAA. Then the documents which had been counterfeited and laundered had to be fenced, is the term I think that purveyors of stolen merchandise use, to the wider world. That was the job of the commercial and the investment banks. That's what they did. And finally, there had to be a victim, a mark. One of the marks apparently was AIG, the insurance company which issued credit default swaps against these instruments, amazingly. But Michael Lewis, in his book, The Big Short, tells us who the other mark was. Who is buying this stuff, someone asked, and the answer came back, Dusseldorf. Dusseldorf. Huh? The stuff was being sold to the world, and in particular to the wealthy world, to Europe. And this is the cause of why I say it's one great crisis, because it's not just an American crisis, it's a global and especially a European crisis, intimately linked. What happened? As the European investors and especially banks realized that their toxic American assets were going to cause them enormous losses, they looked for other assets to sell so that they could gain safety. And so they sold the weak sovereign credits. They sold Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Spain. Okay? Causing an integrated, inseparable, unified crunch on all of those countries, which they could not have prevented by any policy and cannot cure by any actions that they can take on their own. It is the old mountain climbing problem of six people on a rope. If one of them falls, the other five can hold him. If two of them fall, the other four maybe can hold them. If three fall, the other three haven't got a chance, and they either have to let them go, all go together, or cut the rope. And that is the situation facing Europe as we speak, as Italy is in that position of being the third man. Meanwhile, as Rome burned, congressional Neros fiddled away, abetted by the White House in a bipartisan concerto on an irrelevancy none of them understands, budget deficits and the national debt. A sound and light show of no intrinsic economic consequence, despite everything that is said about it, but great potential for harm. I could give you many reasons why the statement I just made is true, but I'll just say that it's obvious that the capital markets, the people with money on the line, agree with me. Even in the enormous fury, now practically forgotten, of what 3 weeks ago over the debt ceiling and the potential default of the U.S. government never before in history and the downgrade of government debt by Standard and Poor's, what happened? People sold other assets to buy United States Treasury bonds because they were safe, and the yields on those bonds didn't rise, they fell. that tells you exactly what you need to know, and you can read it in the paper every single day. Yet the potential for harm is there, and it comes from another emerging consensus, partly amongst economists, and certainly between economists and politicians. While agreeing to disagree over whether another short-term program, another stimulus, would be a good idea, the freshwater people say no, and the saltwater people say yes, this crowd comes into alignment about the long-term, those threatening long-term deficits, which are actually nothing but unreliable projections on somebody's computer. Something must be done, they say. But what can you do today about the long term? You can only cut the programs that have been legislated for the long term. You can't cut the Pentagon budget 10 years from now. It's not appropriated until 9 years from now. So what can you cut? You can cut Medicaid. You can cut Medicare. You can cut Social Security. And a consensus begins to congeal around that program, the agreed-on trade-off, if some pathetic new stimulus is proposed. What is the president offering tonight? I haven't seen the speech. I'm told unemployment insurance extensions, an extended payroll tax cut. These are good things. I'm not opposed to them. They're useful relief, but they will not create jobs. Unemployment insurance is a relief program. It's not a jobs program. An infrastructure bank would be valuable, but it's not a jobs program. And in return, I fear, we will be fed cuts in vital, effective, sustainable programs on which many Americans rely and all of us hope to rely someday. Programs that actually do matter, that have made a great difference in our national life. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. People often ask me to offer a program as I wrap up a speech, and I can do so, focused on jobs and the foreclosure crisis, our need to rebuild the country, energy security, and climate change. But on this occasion, and in part under the strict time constraints of the Cambridge Forum, I will spare you. The most important battle coming up will be to protect, precisely to protect, benefits under Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid from their historic enemies and from those who would trade them off to get through the next election. That's where we need to draw the line. And while you're fighting that fight, as I hope you will in the months ahead, because a great deal is at stake for this generation and the next one, do spare a thought to the administration that enacted two of those programs, Medicare and Medicaid. There are reasons, as I said at the beginning, why the verdict of history on presidents changes, sometimes for the worse and sometimes for the better. Thank you very much.